In an outline, if you didn't get one and would like to have one, wave Brother Spottle there and he'll hand you one on his way back. All right? You know, you're watching a TV series and one episode ends with kind of a cliffhanger, and then the next time the new episode comes on, you see this previously on. And I kind of feel that way with Esther. Previously in the story of Esther. So we kind of catch us up just so we know where we've been. I mean, I said last week that chapter 4, which we looked at last week, was the turning point in the narrative. The defensive pieces God has placed on the board, kind of in the background, nobody's noticed yet. The reader's been aware of them, but nobody else has noticed, are slowly, gradually being brought into play here in chapter 4 and now moving into chapter 5. But they were slow, deliberate movements to counter the plot against the Jews. What's happened in the story? Persian queen has been deposed. The Persian king has been defeated by the Greeks. That part has not been recounted in the scriptural record. He's come back, and they've gathered up all the beautiful young virgins of the land so he could choose. They've all been added to his harem, and he could choose a new queen. An otherwise unknown Jewish maiden has had all of her life plans, whatever they may have been, absolutely destroyed because she's been snatched up and carried into the king's harem. And I have a hard time imagining any young woman having aspired to become one of many concubines to the king. It would take a pretty destitute or avaricious woman to aspire to such a thing. And nobody could have anticipated she'd actually be named the new queen. We've learned a little more about Mordecai, her guardian's, her cousin, who's her guardian's status in the palace, and her beauty and character. Surely she had better prospects than this as being part of the king's harem. But in chapter 3, we find that Mordecai refused to stand when the newly elevated official named Haman walked past. It got reported to Haman. He was so angry, he decided he wouldn't be satisfied with killing Mordecai. He wanted to wipe out all the Jews, every Jew in the kingdom, which is pretty much every Jew everywhere, because the Persian Empire pretty much controlled the populated world other than India and China and parts of Europe under Greek control. But very few Jews were likely to be in any of those places yet. And so he sets out to annihilate all the Jews. Mordecai he hears the announcement that the king has passed this decree that Haman has paid the king for, basically. Mordecai put on sackcloth and ashes, went into public mourning, began to fast. Esther heard about his grief. She didn't know what was going on. She asked him, she sent word to him, find out what's going on. He told her, basically, he implored her to go in and beg the king to rescind the order for the genocide. And she said, you know, I can't do that. If I walk in, anybody walks into the king uninvited, it's death. You know, there's an out. The king can extend his scepter if he's glad to see you. But otherwise, they're just going to haul you out of there and execute you. And he says, you know that. And he said, look, if you don't go, you're going to die. If you do go, you might. Okay, the odds are better for us if you go. And so he charged her to go. And so she said, okay, here's what we'll do. You gather up your people and you contact the Jews and you organize a fast for 3 days. I will get my staff to fast with me for 3 days. And then I'll go see the king. And if I perish, I perish. That's where we left her last week, all right, having made that promise. And so in chapter 5, we pick up there. Let's ask the Lord to bless our study as we get into the text this evening. Father, we ask that you would bless as we investigate your word. Help us to understand not just the historical events, although that's important, but help us to understand the character that's being displayed, the principles that are being illustrated for us to for our own instruction, so that we can learn how you work and how we should live and how we can trust you in your promises to guide and direct and protect and to keep your promises to your people. Encourage our hearts through our study of your word tonight, Lord, in Jesus' name. Amen. Well, chapter 5 is really going to lay the groundwork for the surprises and ironic twists that are going to appear in chapter 6. It's still kind of background to some of those things. And so chapter 5 opens with something I've just called Esther's Banquet. Esther's Banquet in verses 1 through 8. And in the first 5 verses, we have Esther's first invitation. It came about on the third day that Esther put on her royal robes and stood in the inner court of the king's palace in front of the king's rooms. And the king was sitting on his royal throne in the throne room opposite the entrance to the palace. When the king saw Esther the queen standing in the court, she obtained favor in his sight. And the king extended to Esther the golden scepter which was in his hand. So Esther came near and touched the top of the scepter. Then the king said to her, "What is troubling you, Queen Esther, and what is your request? Even to half of the kingdom it shall be given to you." Esther said, "If it pleases the king, may the king and Haman come this day to the banquet that I have prepared for him." Then the king said, "Bring Haman quickly that we may do as Esther desires." So the king and Haman came to the banquet which Esther had prepared. This is a fascinating scene if you try to visualize what's going on. Here, the first five verses is Esther's first invitation. I said she's keeping her promise. There's been no delay. She has her three-day fast, and it was on the third day. Her three-day fast has just ended. And so, number one, her three-day fast had ended. And so, on this third day, apparently toward the end of the day, she laid aside her sackcloth, washed off all the ashes. Understand, she's not seen the king in over a month. She's made that clear. She told Mordecai she hadn't been called to see the king in over a month. She has no idea how he's going to respond to her presence in the courtroom if she walks in. She's had no contact with him, but she doesn't want him to see any evidence of fasting or mourning. And so she takes off the sackcloth, washes off the ashes, gets herself cleaned up, and puts on her royal robes. She donned her royal robes. She did not, first of all, want to betray any hint of her fast or her mourning. Now, I don't know whether it was protocol in the king's court to always appear in your best attire. Maybe so. We've already heard that the king wouldn't allow anybody in sackcloth to come through the gate into the palace. Maybe it was that it was just protocol. She needed to get dressed up in her best attire to go. But I can think of a couple of the reasons why she might have done this. Why she might not have just gone I would imagine she's queen. Her everyday clothes are probably pretty nice, all right? I don't know what her wardrobe looked like, but it probably wasn't a stingy wardrobe. But she put on her robes of state, if you will. For one thing, she's going in at great risk, and I can imagine she would feel just a little more confident dressed in those robes of state. It does speak to her position. It demonstrates, it illustrates to everybody in the room that she outranks everybody but the guy on the throne. Okay? That's going to make everybody think twice before they grab her and haul her out to behead her, right? Or impale her, which would have been the typical means of executing in the Persian Empire. The guards who are going to be on duty are going to be showing her just a little more deference, right? After church today, I didn't change. Sherry said, "Why don't you change clothes before you go pick up lunch?" I said, "No, I'll just go like this." And you know, you walk into the. I was just going to Publix to pick up a sandwich, and it's just people look at you a little different if you go in a suit than if you go in jeans and a sweatshirt. All right. Sometimes I'll have people ask me for directions to something on a shelf because they think I'm in charge or something. Right? If you're just standing around, people think you're in charge. But it's interesting. People respond differently to you depending on how you're dressed. And I would imagine that had something to do with Esther's thinking. She put on her royal robes, her robes of state. She'll be treated with a little more respect, maybe even a little bit of fear if she shows up in these robes. And it's not going to hurt anything if the king first gets sight of her looking absolutely her most radiant and best, right? That's not going to hurt her chances to be welcomed in to see the king, make him happy to see her. So in she walks. Now, excavations have indicated that the king's rooms, the king had his own place in the palace. The queen stayed in her own rooms, and then there was the harem, and her rooms were attached to the harem. The king's rooms were separate from those. And the inner court of the king's palace, his rooms opened out onto a courtroom. Large square room. Imagine it's kind of like this. It's a little bigger than this. All right, large square room. His throne was at one end, and there was a main entrance over there. Esther came in from that entrance, and he's sitting up here with whatever's going on in there. She walks in, says nothing. Again, I think that's protocol. You don't speak in the presence of the king until he grants you permission to speak. She comes in, and she takes her stand. It says twice that she stood in the court. It makes that point twice. She was stood in the inner court, and he saw her standing in the court. She wasn't hiding. She wasn't hoping he didn't notice. She was there to make a point. She was there to get his attention. So she walks in, takes her stand, and she entered the court and stood before the king, number three. And her presence commanded the attention of anybody there. You know, this room is not just the king. He's got other people there. He's got his guards. He's got whatever's going on, whatever business he's conducting there. Now, she had no way to anticipate what the king's mood might be. She didn't know what was going on. The only way she's going to survive this act of walking into this room is if he's happy to see her. And the only way he would demonstrate that is if he acknowledged her by extending his scepter to her. So she, I imagine she's not breathing as she stands there waiting to see how he responds. Well, he extends his scepter to her. She demonstrates her deference by doing something that's not explained, but evidently part of the protocol. She walked forward and touched the top of his scepter. And you understand that the king understands just as well as she does how much she risked by entering this room. This is not a casual encounter. The King James translates his first question to her, "What wilt thou?" Here it says, "What is troubling you?" It's interpretive a bit. Literally, the Hebrew asks, "What to you?" The idea is clearly there's an issue or you wouldn't be here. What might it be? And then he goes on to clarify, "What is your request?" And he promised her even to half the kingdom. I understand that was probably hyperbole. He probably didn't mean literally he's offering her half the territory and control of that. But the idea is the king is offering, you know, very broad parameters. I'll give you whatever you ask. Within very broad limits. Up to half the kingdom. He offered to give her whatever she wanted. And it, you know, the first time reader is going to be a little surprised with her answer. She says, "Why don't you meet me for dinner this evening?" There is no way anybody would take this risk to invite him to dinner. None. And the king knows that. He knows she didn't just come in to ask me to dinner. She didn't come in just because she misses me. She's not here because she's not risking this possible execution for a dinner companion. So then she said, "I want you and Haman to come now to a banquet I've prepared. Not tomorrow, not later, not next week. Not, I want you to come to dinner, you tell me what day you're available. Come now." She's communicating to the king, "I have an urgent need that I need to communicate to you, and there's a different venue I have in mind." And the king's not an idiot, although sometimes he behaves as one in this story. Said, "Come this day." The day's evidently nearing the end. Now, she calls it a banquet. Now, the English word banquet implies maybe a large company or at least a lavish meal. The word literally means a meal with emphasis on drinking. Four times this word appears in Daniel, and each of those four times is translated drink. It's a drinking dinner, all right? Come for food and drinks is what she's inviting him for. And I've already talked about in chapter 1 how important drinking was to the Persian king and to his court. I will tell you this. There are several writers who point this out, that in the Hebrew, they say that the name of God has been identified hidden in her invitation. In the fact that when she says, "May the king come this day," if you take that's four words in the Hebrew, and if you take the first letter of each word, it spells out the name of God, Yahweh. Now, what none of those writers bother pointing out is you have to skip the words "and Haman" for that anagram to work. Right? I think you're trying too hard to find God in the text, if that's the kind of stuff you have to look for. And Brenneman, in his commentary, agrees with me, all right? Or I'll agree with Brenneman. He says, "Such cryptic codes are not needed to find God in the text. The course of events is the best evidence of divine guidance, and all one needs to see the presence of God." That's how he's directing events. Now, some have said, "Well, why didn't she just ask him there? Why didn't she just walk in and tell him what she wanted?" that you've passed a decree that's going to annihilate all my people, and I want you to give us our lives. That's probably a dangerous thing to do in the court with all these witnesses, because that sounds like you're blaming the king. She needed a better place, a little more intimate location and context in which to do this. If for no other reason, she's thinking he'll likely to be in a little more receptive mood after a pleasant dinner and a few drinks, given his who he was. And so he's got to be wondering why Haman's invited. Well, given his recent elevation, Haman's inclusion might not be surprising. Jewish commentators have made some interesting suggestions as to why she might have had included Haman in this, or why the king might have thought she had included Haman. Some have suggested that she did it to make the king jealous, as if Haman were somehow a rival for her affections. And so she's going to play the jealousy thing for the king. Others have suggested that she wants the Jews to hear that she invited Haman, and that maybe she's not going to take a stand on our defense, and maybe they won't rely on her to get them out of this, and they'll pray more and trust God. That's so convoluted, I think it's unnecessary. I think the reasoning is fairly simple. She knows when she tells the king what she wants, the king knows Haman's the guy who wrote that edict. He's going to go see Haman in private, and she's not going to be able to be there. It's going to be much better for the whole situation if she can confront Haman in the presence of the king, and he doesn't have a chance to concoct some kind of excuse. It puts him on the spot in this kind of a context. So she invites him to come. And so the king and Haman joined Esther for the banquet. Haman wasn't in court at the time. This indicates that she came in, made her request. Haman wasn't there. The king had to send somebody out to get him and bring him quickly, he says, so that we may do as Esther desires. That's why I think it was probably later in the day then. Dinner was ready. The king seems to have abandoned whatever he was doing at court to go to dinner with the queen. Whatever she had on her mind was pretty important. So this tells you something about his attitude toward her as well. If he's willing to stop everything to come see what's troubling her, so that she was willing to risk being executed to come and ask me to dinner. I do think that the inclusion of Haman probably made him aware, or made him think at least, that this is probably not a personal matter, but one involving the state. Not any other reason to have involved Haman, who is the Grand Vizier at this point. Well, in verses 6 to 8, we have Esther's second invitation. In verses 6 to 8, as they drank their wine at the banquet, the king said to Esther, "What is your petition? For it shall be granted to you. And what is your request? Even to half of the kingdom it shall be done." So Esther replied, "My petition and my request is, if I have found favor in the sight of the king, and if it pleases the king to grant my petition to do what I request, may the king and Haman come to the banquet which I will prepare for them, and tomorrow I will do as the king says." Really? Did she chicken out? We got to wait till the next episode to find out what's going on? And yeah, we do. She makes a second invitation. I mean, he knew that eating together hadn't been the point. And so after dinner, he asks her. Frankly, I think he's giving her permission to speak when he asks her, "Okay, what is your petition?" And I called him Xerxes here because that's the Greeks called this king Xerxes, Ahasuerus, promised to grant whatever she asked. Xerxes or Ahasuerus, the same guy, promised to grant her whatever she asked, again repeating that hyperbolic promise even to half the kingdom, emphasizing his willingness to be very generous. And she starts to answer, and you're holding your breath. She's finally going to tell him, and she says, I want you to come to dinner again tomorrow. Well, obviously, that's not the issue either. And she makes it clear, she's not pretending this whole thing was to get him to come to dinner 2 days in a row. She says, "If you'll come to dinner tomorrow, I'll tell you then." And so she invited him to a second banquet tomorrow. And there, in his commentary, Stevenson cites a dozen different commentators' suggestions on why she did this. And it's interesting, some of the varieties. McCree says that her courage failed, she chickened out. Naomi Rosenblatt suggests that she wanted an opportunity to influence the king through intimacy. She wanted him to spend the night with her that night, and maybe then she could get him to go along with her request. That's a little bit of a stretch, especially since, as you read on in the next chapter, that's not what happened. He's by himself in his chambers, can't sleep, and is having the chronicles read to him to try to get him to get something done or get some sleep. So he's by himself. That's kind of a bizarre interpretation. McIntyre thinks she sensed the king's mood was not yet right to be receptive to a request. Maybe. Levinson says maybe she thought he wasn't drunk enough and she'd try again tomorrow. Okay. That's a possibility, I suppose. One thinks that it was a calculated move to heighten his suspense. Another thinks the opposite, that she thought he was too tense and she wants him more relaxed. You know, nobody knows. The point is, whatever reason she had for delaying and asking, it may not have actually been what she started to say. But whatever reason it was, this reminds me a little bit of Balaam when he starts to talk and words come out that aren't what he meant to say, but it ends up being a blessing. The outcome made the night's delay necessary. Because what happens during the night is critical for what happens at dinner tomorrow. And that's what happens in the next chapter, actually. And we're not going to get to that part tonight. She was not pretending dinner was her ultimate request. She's going to reveal her petition at the second dinner. What's going to happen between now and tomorrow night's dinner is Haman's hatred for Mordecai is going to reach its pinnacle. His desire to get rid of Mordecai is going to be manifested. The king is going to discover Mordecai had done him a great service, and he's going to decide to reward Mordecai. Haman's fortunes are going to be turned upside down, and Mordecai's too, and everything's going to turn around overnight. There's no way Esther expected that. She could not have engineered it. It's something only God could do. But that's jumping ahead in the story to what we'll look at in a couple of weeks. Not next week, next week's business meeting. So right now, at the end of her banquet, even though Xerxes has twice this evening promised her to do whatever she asked, even to half the kingdom, she risks his changing his mind by delaying till tomorrow to tell him what she wants. Now, I don't know why the king can't sleep. Maybe he's eager to hear whatever Esther wants. Maybe he's worried about whatever Esther wants. But he can't sleep that night. Maybe he's indigestion from the food. I don't know. The rich food. But Haman's boasting then in verses 9 to 14. Look at verse 9. Haman went out that day glad and pleased of heart. Here's a guy who's assuming he has finally arrived. The king had lifted him up, made him his second in command, and even the queen had favored him with an invitation to dine with herself and the king alone. And not only did we have dinner tonight, she invited me back tomorrow. This has been a great day for Haman. And then he saw Mordecai. But when Haman saw Mordecai in the king's gate, and that he did not stand up or tremble before him, Haman was filled with anger against Mordecai. Now, the King James says that Mordecai didn't move for him, and it's important to note that he does not mean that Mordecai didn't get out of his way to make way for him. It means to tremble, as it is here, that Haman thought Mordecai should shake in his boots when he saw him coming, and he didn't. He didn't look scared, and so Haman was mad. So Mordecai was filled with anger. He was glad and pleased a minute ago, and then he saw Mordecai, and now he's filled with anger against Mordecai. Verse 10, Haman controlled himself, however, went to his house, sent for his friends, and for his wife Zeresh. He went home and sent for his wife and friends. I mean, he didn't lash out. You get the feeling he's going to lash out. He didn't. He controlled his rage. And we see he went home to boast and to whine, is what he's going to be doing here in just a moment. names sometimes have interesting meanings. F.B. Huey mentions Zeresh's name, his wife's name. Zeresh is a Persian name. And linguists disagree over the etymology of the word. It's either a word that means golden, or perhaps more likely, and ladies, you'll love this, it's a word that means one with disheveled hair. Haman's wife is the one with the wild hair day, every day. Okay? Okay? With disheveled hair. I don't know. Either golden or one with disheveled hair, one or the other. Take your pick. Well, he gets home, he calls his friends and his wife Zeresh, and he told them the story. He boasted of his own glory. The Haman recounted to them the glory of his riches, the number of his sons, and every instance where the king had magnified him, and how he had promoted him above the princes and servants of the king. And Haman also said, even Esther the queen, let no one but me come to the king, come with the king to the banquet which she had prepared. And tomorrow also I'm invited by her with the king. And this is a man who's excited about all this stuff, all these great things, and his own glory, his wealth first. And we don't know exactly how wealthy he is. It's already been evidenced probably in this promise to pay to the king's treasury 375 tons of silver if he'd let him sign this edict for the annihilation of the Jews. I don't know. That may be what he's planning to collect from the seizing of property. But it's also possible he's planning to pay that right out of his own pocket, out of his own accounts, as it were. He's a pretty wealthy fellow. So he's bragging about his riches. He's bragging about the number of his sons. According to the Greek historian Herodotus, the Persians held in highest esteem were those men with the most sons. And so he's bragging about the number of his sons. We don't know for sure how many sons he had. Esther chapter 9, verse 10 mentions the 10 sons of Haman. However, the Aramaic targums indicate that in those records and commentaries of the Jews, they claim that Haman had 208 sons. It was not at all unusual for wealthy men that were high-ranking officials in the king's court in Persia to have harems of their own, sometimes with enough women that 208 sons was not outlandish. And so if he's boasting about how many sons he has, 10's probably not enough to take the lead, okay, on that score. We don't know. According to those targums, he had 208 sons. 10 of them held office in the king's court, and one of whom was the king's scribe, maybe the guy who actually penned the edict that Haman dictated. We don't know for sure, but he's boasting about the number of his sons. We know he had at least 10. And then he's also boasting the favor showed to him by the king. He's elevated me, and he mentions everything the king's had him do, and what a wonderful thing the king has done for him, and how his star is rising, as it were. And the icing on the cake is that Esther had invited only him to join her with the king for dinner tonight and even tomorrow. And I've just come from dinner, and I get to go back again tomorrow. I tell you what. Things are really turning out good for me. And then the next is just so sad. It's so pathetic when you think about it. After all this, in verse 13, he says, yet all this does not satisfy me every time I see Mordecai the Jew sitting in the king's gate. Poor Haman. I got all this, and it's not enough. Poor me. There's that rascal Mordecai. He won't tremble when I walk by. So he whined that seeing Mordecai left him unsatisfied. How many times have we noted that it doesn't matter how much you have, it just won't be enough? Here's another guy who proves that. If all you want stuff and all you want is fame and all you want is power, there isn't enough to satisfy you. You'll never be satisfied. And that's true for Haman right here. He whined because Mordecai, just sitting there, so smug. Okay? And so, his friends and his wife were so sympathetic. So they told him what he should do. Zeresh, his wife, and all his friends said to him, have a gallows 50 cubits high made, and in the morning ask the king to have Mordecai hanged on it. Then go joyfully with the king to the banquet. And no surprise, the advice pleased Haman. So he had the gallows made. He erected 50 cubits, 75 feet. Now, there are critics who would say, well, nobody can build a gallows that fast overnight like that. You're thinking way too elaborate here, a structure way too elaborate. All he needed was a 75-foot pole on which to impale Mordecai. That's what this word means. He's not hanging him from a rope, like from a gallows, like we think of. We picture something in the Old West. But this is just a pole on which he could be impaled. And a 75-foot-high pole, bear in mind that the palace walls, I already told you that the palace at Susa, you've got the city of Susa as the capital. The citadel is a palace with fortified walls. Do you remember how high I said they were? 72 feet. 72 feet. It's almost certain Haman lived just outside the citadel. And if he has a house that backs up, his property backs up to the wall, it would be very easy to erect a pole that's 75 feet tall that sticks up above that. All it has to stick up about that high above the top of the wall so that Mordecai can be impaled there and everybody in the court can see him right there. And he's 75 feet off the ground. And that's exactly what Haman wants. Not only does he want Mordecai dead, he wants Mordecai humiliated, and he wants everybody at court to know this is what happens to people who show disrespect to me. This would not be a tremendous feat of engineering to get this kind of a structure erected overnight. Besides which, he has pretty much the entire palace under his command. He can do what he wants, and he can get as much help as he needs. And so he erected this pole on which to impale Mordecai. He's going to do it in the morning. And here's the plan. I'll get this built. I'll show up first thing in the morning. I'll get Mordecai hanged on it. I can gloat over his dead body out there, or dying body out there, all day long. Everybody will know. All glory to Mordecai. All glory goes to Haman. And then when I go to dinner with the king and his wife, everything will be great. And I won't have to worry about that smirking Jew next time I walk by. That's the plan. Well, you know what the Scottish poet said about the best laid plans of mice and men. Gang off to glee. We'll see how that works out next time. Sorry, I don't mean these cliffhangers, but that's the way it's written. And so we'll come to chapter 6 in a couple of weeks and just a couple of lessons. And I know this is short, but I definitely didn't have time to go on into the next chapter. Now, I did not include among our lessons this week the one that's kind of a recurring theme throughout this book is the behind-the-scenes working of the hand of God in all of these events. That's not as obvious in this chapter as it has been in some of the others, and not nearly as obvious as it will be in the next chapter. All right? It's true, we continue to see God's maneuvering of the pieces and his direction of the course of events so that his outcome is in fact what occurs. But what I want to say, just from the example of Haman, happiness based on circumstances is fleeting. If it takes praise at work, lots of money, lots of glory, if that's what it takes to make you happy, and all it takes is one guy sneering at you or calling you a name to ruin your day, the problem isn't with that guy. Right? If one insult can ruin your day, the problem's not with the person who insulted you. We need to have our lives more together than that, don't we? We need to be more dependent on the Lord. I don't see any evidence that Mordecai goes home thinking, I was having such a good day until that rascal Haman walked by. Mordecai's just minding his business. And he's not letting Haman bother him too much, worry him too much. And all the stuff, Haman was thrilled. He was having such a great day, and it all evaporated when he saw Mordecai. Because he's basing his happiness, his joy in life is all coming from the wrong source. And And if that's what it takes to make you happy, you're never going to be satisfied. Just like Haman was not satisfied. And with these events here, the stage is set to show something too. On the other side of that, if we think for a moment about Mordecai, who hasn't really been present in this chapter, we're going to see how God can use one person's willingness to risk his life for God's glory. Both Esther's case and Mordecai's case. One person's willingness to risk their life for God's glory to transform society. You say, well, what difference can one person make? The answer is, you don't know. You never know what difference one person can make. As Mordecai had said to Esther, who knows but what you have come into the kingdom for such a time as this. You don't know what taking the right stand might accomplish. Yeah, it could be costly. And if she did risk her life going in to see the king, right? The fact that he didn't kill her doesn't change the risk. But when we start to feel a little discouraged and we look at life and we look at the world and we think, oh, everything's so awful. I can't make any difference, can I? Well, you just don't know. Take your stand and trust the Lord. Take your stand and trust the Lord. That's all God calls on us to do. Let's pray.